welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, along with Will Lynn, who is joining me for our eighth consecutive month of Mythosophia, entertaining the depths of myth and wisdom. And I want to welcome you back to our program, Will.
Thank you.
This is going to be a most fascinating program because it's going to go into an area that I have not really covered on this program. In the we're actually going into our eighth year in September of this program. I've stayed away from this area because I really don't know how to get into it without having some of the connotations that might come up from people saying, "Ah, there he goes, another one of those nut jobs, another one of those Art Bell wannabes."
And,
and it's like, okay, I will be the first to acknowledge, I will state that I do believe that it is the height of arrogance of man to think that he is the only living being in the universe. I also think it's the height of arrogance, as much as I love Star Trek, to think that there are only humanoid beings out there. Although the next generation did start to deal with like the crystalline entity and some of the jellyfish looking things and that type of thing. We can't be the only thing. And I also don't believe that this is an accident, that there is a purpose to all of this. What it is, I don't know. I'm trying to find that out like everyone else.
And you know, beneath the well, first of all, we're really lucky to be able to talk about this with somebody who can talk about this responsibly. You know, and that's the opportunity that I think we have.
Exactly.
You know, Jeff Kripal is the name of the scholar that's going to visit us, and we'll do a full bio when we introduce him. But, you know, in short, he's the J. Newton Raiser Professor of Philosophy and Religious Thought and has had the privilege to step down from the chair position from the Department of Religious Studies at Rice University, where he continues to teach. And so Jeff spent a lot of time in mysticism and some other like really kind of taboo areas for academia, but really with some with real rigor, you know, and with real scholarship. And now he's finally he says it's his part of his midlife crisis to turn back towards an interest in comic books and some of this occult material. And certainly he sees it as related or contingent with mystical powers and other religious and mythological concepts.
It's one of the things that intrigues me, of course, especially about religion, and of course, being born and raised in the Catholic Church in the Western Rite, and I make that distinction because in my first marriage, I was able to become involved in what was called the Eastern Rite of the Catholic Church. People thought it was Greek Orthodox or Orthodox, and I would always have to correct them, saying, "No, they're still under the Pope. They still acknowledge him as the leader of the Universal Church." But that the thing that always drew me into either aspect, East or West, was the ritual and symbolism, the traditions and rituals of the church, not really knowing what they were all about. And then, of course, you know, you saw the Dan Brown books come out about the church and all of the occult aspects, the symbology, and so forth. I even had to correct somebody when being taken to task about a program I used to produce. I wasn't hosting it, but I was producing it, called the Radio Family Rosary Program. And they jumped all over me about that, saying, "Oh, this is satanic, and it's this, and it's that, and it's the other." And I said, okay, if you're going to use the Bible as your primer, if you're going, if that's going to be your source material, I can emphatically state that there isn't one word in the rosaries that isn't in the Bible. Okay?
Interesting.
So until you understand that it is a meditative prayer, and until you grasp or accept that it is possible to receive intercessory prayer even from those who have gone on ahead of us, then you're barking up the wrong tree. And I really had a problem with that kind of criticism.
Well, there are a couple things. You know, one thing that I want to respond to is that iconoclasm, and my girlfriend just wrote an essay on this, and how you know, Protestantism led to a real attack of symbolism, an attack of icons. You know, even and then you point back to the Moses scene, but certainly between the Moses scene and the Protestant intense, you know, we will not look at any images. There were definitely there was definitely a lot of interest in imagery, religious imagery, in the Abrahamic faiths, and I think obviously with the rosary is a good example of symbols that are still really important.
Yeah.
And so what I think Jeff might suggest is that these kind of symbols and these kinds of and I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I think this is what he would say, that they are opportunities to see beyond what the symbol actually is. And I think Campbell says the same thing. There's something beyond the symbols and the characters and the imagery mm-hmm. that we're mm-hmm. actually using. These are like these are just like helpers to help us get to something even more direct and potent. And
exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that was one of the things in this conversation I had with this person, and that is that if it helps you to have a stronger faith, if it helps you to get through a rough patch in your life, what's wrong with that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. sounding a little
Seinfeldish. He's gonna get into this too.
I don't understand what's wrong with having a prayer of the rosary.
If it helps people.
Exactly.
And
the same thing with the icons, the statues, mm-hmm. the stained glass, all of the other elements, the mitre with the incense. That was one of the things that always intrigued me, was I knew that I would have that fragrance when I would go into the church. And, of course, on warm days, since there was no AC in this particular church, you could run the risk of passing out, which I came close to once.
Uh-huh.
But there was something so beautiful, and I commend my mother for her stance when I didn't want to go to Mass when I was 16. And she said, okay, fine. And it was years later that I asked her why she did that. She said, I didn't want you to leave the church. I didn't want you to push away. And I never did. I'm no longer a practicing Catholic in that context. Mm-hmm. But I still have this great love as well as reverence.
She never set you up to rebel against
it. No, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, and so I have no... I'm not interested necessarily in getting back into the practice, but I have no rebellious... bones in my body regarding the church. But that's also one of the reasons why I have always researched other religions as well, and also tried to keep an open mind, regardless of whether it was one of the main ones that's mentioned or some of the what we might call more occult, you know, metaphysical, if you will, mystical.
Yep.
You know,
and that's where I want to help. I want to dive right in with that, and to two questions. Or, you know, first, one of the things that really attracted me to Jeff was his point that, you know, if you want to study religion, if you want to study myth, how can you possibly justify pulling the occult off the table, pulling these experiences of original religious experiences off the table? How can we possibly take these accounts that go back from, you know, well before Jesus's time of you know, maybe just shamanic times, of real direct experiences of something divine, whether it happened or not, that's not our conversation. These accounts exist and have always existed, and they certainly exist now. When we look at all the alien movies that we're interested in, one of the things Jeff points out is, well, these are not disconnected from the real life experiences of people at least believing that they're experiencing these events. So how can we separate the study of story out from the occult and from the paranormal?
Yeah.
And that's why we got to have this episode.
Well, and of course, working for a religious station for the number of years that I did, and I was just looking back on that, 15 years I was there, and it seems today like it was just a blip.
Uh-huh.
But it was, I took the position that I cannot take away someone else's experience. I cannot devalue it by saying, no, there's nothing in the Bible that says blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, you that was something of the devil, you know, demeaning it, you know, and so forth. I can't do that.
And speaking of devil worshipers, who do you think we're saving right now in Iraq? It's the Yazidi, who everybody says they're the devil worshippers because they worship Satan. But look closely at their religion. It's not what we would think of as satanic.
Yeah. Oh, and then, of course, there's the other aspect, too, in terms of possibly, and I say this euphemistically, maybe, getting into bed with someone we've been against for so long in Syria. And now all of a sudden it's like, well, you know, maybe we need this guy's help in order to defeat the people who are a greater evil than him.
Hey, you know.
And it's just, it's you know, I mean, that's a political thing, I suppose. But at the same time, all of these conflicts, from my perspective, regardless of what part of the world, seem to be around religion, religious belief systems, philosophies that one group says that they are going to be
the dominant over-obsessed force. With the map. If they would see past the images and past the characters and into what it's about, into this more direct experience and the deeper potencies of and meanings.
The destination.
We wouldn't be fighting over what our confusions over differences in our maps, you know? And that's what it seems to really be.
Well, I'm really, as you've stated, even before we started, really looking forward to this because we've had some extraordinary and incredible programs in the last 7 months. And I have to say that I think that this is quite a culmination here as we get into our August Mythosophia program. I'm Richard Dugan. We're here with Will Lynn, and we're going to get our guest on the line here in just a moment via Skype, and we're going to talk about some of these incredible things from the paranormal and various religions. We'll talk about aliens and that type of thing. Matter of fact, before we break here, Will, there's a gentleman I'm thinking about having on the program, and after this one I may do it. He's written a book called A.D., AD has to do with after disclosure.
Ah, I've heard about this.
Yes, and I remember when I first was exposed to the book, my first question to this gentleman is going to be, basically, all right, let's assume that your premise is true, that the government will disclose. The government's been lying to us for the last 50 or 60 years about all of this, right? So what makes you think that the people are going to accept the government's a declaration
Now
of disclosure.
Now you're
telling us the truth. We don't. We didn't believe you then. We don't believe you now.
Yeah,
because you will not accept us as
already
having these
wolf.
Experience. Exactly. So it'll be an interesting program. But I think this is as well. And
well, in addition,
just a quickie. Just tell us. We have the gentleman who do we have coming up.
The next interview, while we're talking about future interviews, will be with Dr. Eisenstadt, who's the president and founder of Pacifica. So that should be great.
Looking forward to that.
Yeah.
And I believe there's a shot we may be doing that on location.
Yeah, I think we're going to do that on location.
That'll be great.
And hopefully Pacifica has been so good about this drought. They've let their grass die out of kindness. So I hope it's grown back, and I hope we can get some beautiful shots of the campus while we're there. But if not, it's because they're doing something
even prettier. Hey, we can Photoshop it in.
Yeah, right. Well, I think we're pretty much ready. One thing I just want to point out is that as we're getting into the occult, we've done other genres like epic and sci-fi. The occult and the paranormal are not exactly a genre, even though there might be stories like Lucy or Ghostbusters that really almost make it its own genre. But if we look at comic books and science fiction and all kinds of stuff, we'll see this occult and especially this paranormal activity extend beyond genre.
This is going to be great. All right, well, stay with us, everyone. We're going to be coming back with more of Mythosophia, entertaining the depths of myth and wisdom here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Stay right where you are as we finish up the last day in August.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, along with my co-host, Will Lynn. And we're here talking in our series on Mythosophia, entertaining the depths of myth and wisdom. And today we have a very special guest. It's going to be an extraordinary program. So why don't we get right to it and tell us who do we have via Skype? And this is going to be extraordinary. Will?
So Jeffrey J. Creepall is the J. Newton Razor Professor of Philosophy and Religious Thought and former chair of the Department of Religious Studies at Rice University. He received his PhD from the University of Chicago Divinity School, where he worked on his dissertation with Dr. Wendy Doniger. He's the author of 6 books, Comparing Religions, Mutants and Mystics, Science Fiction, Superhero Comics, and the Paranormal, Authors of the Impossible, the Paranormal and Sacred, Esalen, America and the Religion of No Religion, The Serpent's Gift, Gnostic Reflections on the Study of Religion, Roads of Excess, Palaces of Wisdom, Eroticism, and Reflexivity in the Study of Mysticism, and Kali's Child, The Mystical and the Erotic in the Life and Teachings of Ramakrishna. 2 of these have been optioned for documentaries that are currently in production, and his areas of interest include revisioning and renewing the comparative method in the study of religion and comparative erotics of mystical literature, American countercultural translations of Asian religious traditions, and the history of Western esotericism from ancient Gnosticism to the New Age. He also thinks he may be Spider-Man. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Thanks a lot, Will.
It's great to have you on the program. And of course, I've been taking a look at the information that Will's provided about the various different subject matters and your book, Mutants and Mystics. I'm really curious as to how you got started in all this. This is not, something that most people just, they fall into. There's got to be some catalytic event or what have you that took place.
Now, Richard, when you say all of this, what are you referring to?
Well, the paranormal, the mysticism, all of the different aspects, especially weaving into it. And I can't see how any of this stuff is unrelated, any of these topics. Comic book heroes and so forth. There's like a high-end imaginative spirit that you seem to have.
Oh, thank you. Well, there are different reasons that, each of those books is very different. But generally speaking, the first three books are about erotic mystical literature. And so for the first really half of my career, I was interested in really the interface between human sexuality and ecstatic or visionary religious experiences. And so that's really what I was trying to get at with those first three books, particularly male mystical literature. I was interested in its relationship to mysticism.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then, Richard, the last three books really were all generated by my interest in the human potential movement in 07. And that's really where the interest in the paranormal comes from, is talking to human beings in that movement who had some extraordinary experience, and then trying to figure out how to write about those things in intelligent ways. That is neither naive nor dismissive.
And that's why I think we feel so fortunate to have you with us today, is this stuff is highly attractive to talk about, yet at the same time very difficult to talk about. And you came in and presented a colloquium at Pacifica, and that's one of the things that I was talking with some classmates that were so important that we learned from you, which is how to talk about some things that are difficult. But to do it with such grace. So I admire you taking on that challenge of talking about such difficult things with such intelligence.
Well, thanks. I mean, we can get into this during the show, but my basic point on that day was that, the humanities, the study of literature and religion, have a lot to offer here. And normally the way the paranormal is addressed is either through a kind of simplistic science or through a kind of debunking strategy. And my point that day was, well, actually, these things are much more fruitfully approached if we look at them as living literature or as religious experiences.
Well, let me set you up to maybe say more about that and ask you. You spent some time in your book, Mutants and Mystics. You talk about another book called The Book of the Damned. What's damned about this book?
Well, The Book of the Damned was the first book that Charles Fort published on this material back in 1919. And really the genesis of this project for me was, again, encountering these friends and colleagues in the human potential movement who were telling me these impossible things. And me realizing that, I had studied mystical literature for 25 years and I basically had nothing. I had no idea how to even respond to these people. And I realized when I looked at the history of the field that all of our founders, all of the founders of the study of religion in the late 19th, early 20th century were completely mesmerized extensively. But over the course of the 20th century, we gradually took all of that stuff off the table. We damned it in Fort's sense. What he meant by that was we ignore it or we make fun of it, or we dismiss it with sort of fake explanations. We do anything in our power not to look at it because we recognize on some level we've got nothing. And so what I was trying to do in those last three books is sort of put all the weird stuff that we put in the trash can underneath the table and put it back on top of the table and just start to talk about it in a way that is calm and sympathetic, but again, not naive or too believing.
So as far as the human potential movement is concerned in relation to this, Jeffrey, I'm curious, As to your own experience, have you had any of these kinds of mystical experiences that you've researched? Because the question was asked of me, for example, by my mother many years ago, if I'd ever had any supernatural experiences. To which I said, well, if I have, they didn't seem to be out of the ordinary. And I used the comparison, not to compare myself, but Jesus, for example, according to what's in the Bible, had all of these various miracles that he performed. But for him, that was normal. That's just what he did. It wasn't extraordinary to him. And I'm just wondering, when you start talking about the human potential movement and what they promote, maybe we haven't reached our full potential yet, and that some of the things that he did, and even he said that we these kinds of works we would do, but greater works, you know, maybe we just haven't gotten there yet. What about you?
Well, you just opened up a can of worms.
Well, that was my intention.
we can get into X-Men now if you want. We don't have to do it later.
No, where do you want to start? I mean, you asked me about whether I had had such experiences. You asked me about the supernatural, and you referenced the paranormal and the human potential movement. I mean, do you want me to just go through those, or what?
Let's talk about your personal experiences. Have you had?
Let's start there, and then we'll go. We'll start with what normal is after we give a good starter example.
Okay.
Okay.
So my experiences of these things are very humble. I've had any number of what Jung called synchronicities. Those are fairly common. They tend to happen around my writing practice. And I've had really just one kind of overwhelming, drop your jaw, bizarre religious experience, which was in India in 1989, in which some kind of energy entered me when I was sleeping and took over my body, and it was very dramatic. I thought I was dying. I thought I was having a heart attack because it was centered in the heart. And then I thought I was being electrocuted because it was very palpable, magnetic or plasmic kind of experience. And then it resulted in an out-of-body experience that developed, and then I came back. So that was extremely powerful. I didn't think of that as paranormal at the time. I thought of it in the tantric terms that I was studying. It was a Shaktipat experience, a kind of transmission. But I do think that one experience sort of opened me up in a way that makes me sympathetic to people who relate similar types of experiences in very different mythical frameworks. I mean, when you listen to a lot of alien abduction accounts, they essentially sound exactly like that.
Mm-hmm.
Only they don't involve an Indian goddess. They involve, an alien. So, I'm very sympathetic, I think, because of that experience. But I don't claim to be gifted here. I don't claim to be able to replicate these things. I can't. And I suspect most people can't. So in terms of, the other thing you said, which I do want to sort of address immediately, because it's really important. There's a huge conceptual difference between the supernatural and the paranormal. The supernatural is an old medieval theological term, and it implies some distinct difference between the natural order and the divine order. And so a supernatural event is one in which the divine intervenes into the world and does something extraordinary or miraculous. That's what a miracle is. It's a sign of the divine.
A break from what is
normal.
Yeah.
From what is normal. Mm-hmm. A miracle is not normal. That's why it's a miracle. And
it's
I would
like it
argue
breaks deterministic physics or something.
Right. And I would argue that Jesus' miracles were not normal for him or anybody else. That's why they were miracles. That's why they were understood to be signs of his divinity. So that's the supernatural and the miraculous. But that is not what the paranormal is. The paranormal was invented right around the turn of the 20th century, 1900, 1901, by French psychologists and researchers. And what they meant by it was some extraordinary event that looks supernatural but probably isn't. It's probably part of the normal world. It's part of the function of nature that we don't yet understand. And so they called it paranormal, which just simply means it's part of the normal world, but it's beyond what we normally experience, and it's beyond our present models. So the example I always give here is the poltergeist, the angry ghost. These researchers called that paranormal, mm-hmm. but they didn't think it was a ghost.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they thought it was a focal agent, a conflicted or upset human being that was emotionally or sexually conflicted and was somehow exteriorizing their emotions into the environment.
Jeffrey,
so they had a natural explanation for it, but it really, really wasn't an explanation because it violates everything we think we know
right.
about.
Now, you've defined some good terms, and I appreciate that. I'd like you to define and differentiate between two other terms that have sort of been mentioned. The difference between your perspective, the difference between mysticism, the mystical world, and miracles.
Well, I mean, so you can have a mystical experience without seeing anything or experiencing anything miraculous. I mean, a miracle, very technically put, is an inbreaking into the natural world in some extraordinary way that gives witness to the truth of a particular religious position or tradition. So, you know, a miraculous healing or the Virgin Mary appearing to, you know, three shepherd children. The miracle always supports or undergirds the religious worldview. That's why it's so different from the paranormal. You know, the paranormal events, it's not clear what they undergird or what they sign, and they often violate the religious world in which they appear. Mysticism, on the other hand, is a word we made up. Well, we made up all these words.
Yes, we did.
But mysticism is one we made up fairly recently in the 17th, 18th century to refer to any kind of direct or immediate experience of the divine that a human being has. And we derived it from the Greek for secret or hidden, mystikos. So, you know, it's a comparative category. And so we today talk about mystics in this or that religious tradition. So it's a very general way of talking. And sometimes those are accompanied by what we would call psychical or paranormal phenomena, and sometimes they're not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, let's step back from the abnormal, and maybe in the colloquium, you had such clear ideas of where we get our sense of normality, and I was wondering if we could start in on that and where we get the framework that defines the paranormal, because I think a lot of people studying the paranormal, I believe yourself included, and what you're saying is that it's not something that's against nature. It's just something we don't necessarily understand. So where do we get our sense of understanding of what nature is, and why does it fall so short of what the paranormal includes?
Well, so I think the basic problem here is that our common sense and much of our science is sense-based. Mm-hmm. You know, it assumes that there's a subject kind of floating somewhere between our ears inside our skull, and that through these senses, they're mediating this thing out there, this world out there. And so there's an inside and there's an outside. There's mm-hmm. a subjective realm and there's an objective realm. And we assume that our senses give us a more or less complete a view of the picture. What's so problematic about paranormal experiences is that they violate, they cut right through that dualism. They almost always involve a subjective element and an objective element that are appearing at the same time. So go to the poltergeist. You have an inner state of sexual or emotional conflict, and you have things blowing up or falling off the wall. That's not supposed to happen.
Mm-hmm.
In the sort of the materialistic picture, our subjective states have no impact on the physical surroundings. It can't happen. But a paranormal experience, it does happen. And this, of course, is what in any earlier period we would have called magic, right? Where you have an internal magic, an internal subjective state influencing an external event. So paranormal events for our ordinary way of understanding the world, because they violate this idea that mind is just something ephemerally produced by brain inside a skull. What it looks like is that mind actually is the physical world, and that it's manipulating all sorts of things.
So, sorry, you cut out just for a second there when you were saying something important, and that was you were talking about mind not as necessarily a irrelevant part of natural operations, and that may be one of the main interpretations of contemporary psychologists and neuroscientists that see us as products of matter, that we are just matter, that our brains are just matter, and that consciousness is just a kind of illusion created by material processes. But you presented another idea that consciousness is actually filtering through the brain as opposed to being generated by it. What's the difference, and what's the importance?
Well, I think that's everything depends on those, which of those two models is correct. And they're probably both correct to a certain extent, right? I mean, the production model is the standard one. It's the one held by most neuroscientists and most people working in the sciences, that mind or consciousness is something that is produced by brain. And it's a kind of product of very elaborate loops and circuits and neurons firing in certain sequences. And it's essentially an illusion. It really doesn't exist, and we don't really exist. Now, of course, there's a lot of apparent evidence for that, which they would point out that when you die or you damage the brain, consciousness is dramatically changed instantly, or it appears it is. The problem is that model simply can't explain all of these other experiences that we have. Well, for one thing, it doesn't explain ordinary consciousness. It really never tells us how we get from a warm piece of muscle or meat in our head to this 3D movie I'm looking at right now, and I assume you're looking at
that big leap.
It really can't explain that. It pretends to, but it doesn't. But more seriously, for the subject we're talking about, when someone has, say, a telepathic experience or a precognitive experience, they know a loved one, for example, is in danger, dying thousands of miles away, or is about to die and before the event, actually, sometimes. What the production model has to do is say that's just a coincidence.
That's all it can say.
That's all they can say, right. Because it completely violates this idea that mind is just brain inside the skull.
And a spooky action at a distance, which materialism can never explain.
Right. But if you move your chips a little on the table and you say, well, what if mind actually is not in the brain? Perhaps the ego is, perhaps Will is, and Richard and Jeff are. But mind is mind, not as ego now. Might actually be distributed throughout the physical world, and maybe throughout space-time, and maybe it's not even in space-time. And then it filters into a local brain like yours or mine and produces a person through that interaction between mind and neurology and psychology and culture and all the things you are or I am. And so if that's the case, then suddenly a precognitive or a telepathic experience poses no problem whatsoever, right? Because mind isn't in the brain, so it can leap from brain to brain, as it were, like a television set.
Well, could you give the example of Mark Twain, because he's a perfect example of both kind of wireless signals he's interested in the telegram, but he also is a very famous real myth maker who had a real experience that you describe of sensing a loved one's death.
Well, he didn't have one experience. He had dozens.
Mm-hmm.
And he tried to publish them in an anonymous essay for Harper's that they, of course, rejected. Because you don't get the most famous writer in the land and take an essay from him and not use his name, right?
Yeah.
That's really dumb. So he finally gave up, and he published actually two essays in his own name that he called Mental Telegraphy. And this was his own expression for these events, and one of them that he talks about in his essay is, or actually he talks about this in his journal, his private diary. He had a dream of his brother Henry's funeral. He was laid out in a metal coffin on two chairs and a bouquet of roses with a a single white roses with a red one in the middle or vice versa. I can never remember which it was. And he had this dream, and it was so real that when he got up, he actually walked to the dead room in town because he thought his brother was really dead. Yeah, so the next day they were separated. Twain got into a fight with the riverboat captain. And about 2 weeks later, Henry was mortally injured in a boiler explosion on a riverboat, and some young doctors gave him too much opium. So Twain then, of course, found out about this and eventually got to the funeral, and his dream played out in perfect detail, down to the bouquet of roses with the single rose in the middle and the metal casket, the whole thing. So basically, Twain saw his brother's funeral two or three weeks before it happened and a couple hundred miles away. And he was completely convinced of that. It wasn't a coincidence. It was what happened. And he thought actually that he was receiving these signals all the time, and it's what produced his literary genius, his own creativity.
And this interest in the telegram would evolve into interest in the radio, interest in cell phone signals, and interest in vibrations and frequencies, because, and my guess is that because they travel in immaterial ways, unlike, material billiard ball atoms or something like that, they operate completely differently. And I was wondering if you could speak to perhaps, well, why, because his thread seems to have been picked up. And I'm wondering if you think, why you think it might be that this telegram radio signal kind of thread is continuing.
Well, I don't actually think it's correct. I mean, the reason is that telepathy doesn't seem to degrade with distance.
Mm-hmm.
And all electromagnetic signals do.
Right.
Okay. But what you see in history is that people, at least particularly in the West, always use technological analogies to try to understand paranormal experiences. So as mental telegraphy with Twain and telepathy with Myers, as a telegram was the big technology. And then it was radio, mental radio. Then it was the television. Now it's the internet. And I honestly think all of these technological models are false. We just desperately want a technology. We want to be a material reality. It has something to do with mind, and mind is not the same thing as matter, and we just have a horrible time for some reason coming to terms with that.
Hey, we all want proof of God's existence, and I'm sure we all want to, that makes sense. That and you talked about even the chariot, Elijah's chariot is a technological example, and I thought that was really inspiring. That perhaps sci-fi is not a new tendency. It's something we've always wanted to write in our most advanced technologies into our fictions.
Elijah was taken up in a chariot, and Ezekiel saw what is described as a chariot. But of course, if you read Ezekiel, it doesn't look anything like a chariot. So people are always using the technology of the time to sort of frame these things. But they just never quite work. And I think our science fiction and our flying saucer language is no different. I don't think it really works. I doubt. I have serious doubts that these are machines in the sky. They look to me more like gods or religious revelations.
Well, you showed those. You really spent some time looking at pre-UFO accounts that we would now totally name a UFO, and you talk about a lot of these early people that had early encounters with aliens refusing to call them aliens, and I think that's really telling.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, historically, these have been omens, from the gods or from the heavens, or they've been semi-divine creatures that interact with human beings, often in very mischievous and troubling ways.
So let me ask, or go ahead, Richard.
Well, I was just going to say that I find your comparisons interesting, because every time I see one of these programs talking about going into the past, taking our technology with us, that the people of the ancient times would perceive us as gods, just simply because we were able to do something that they just didn't understand. At the same time, it's like, all right, given enough time and education, they would eventually understand what it was that we did, Ergo, now we're not gods anymore.
Right. I mean, that whole, see, that's a comparative practice that comes out of, you know, Arthur C. Clarke's famous observation that any advanced technology would look like magic. And basically what's happening there is people in the contemporary world, surrounded by technology and rockets and planes and computers and science fiction, are taking that framework and they're reading it back into the past and assuming that it can be shoved in everywhere when it often can't be. You could just as easily turn the mirror and say, no, the modern UFO experiences are simply religious experiences framed in sci-fi or technological terms. That, you know, I would say, you know, to put Arthur C. Clarke on his head, I would say that any modern religious experience is going to look like technology because we're too spiritually stupid. You know, we want to turn everything into a material object. We've lost any sense of the spiritual or of the religious. And so all we can see is technology.
Well, let me have a fun example for that.
We can't see magic anymore. You know, we've lost our magical sensibilities.
A great comic book example. Oh, sorry, sorry.
No, I'm just going to say I think you're absolutely right. And yet we're always looking. This is one of the things that's always frustrated me when in having conversations with people, especially about religion. And of course, I never get into debates with people about it because we're now talking belief, and you can never win when you're talking belief because the person believes what they believe, and they've already decided. But it's just really interesting because a lot of what I was taught as I was growing up, both in the Catholic Church as well as what I heard from the religious people from the station I worked for, didn't make sense in my brain. It didn't fit logically. And maybe that's where part of the problem is, because I think one of the wonderful phrases, for example, in this case from the Bible, where it says, come to me as little children. Well, children don't think logically. Mm-hmm. They see what they see and they have fun with it, or they don't.
The imagination is still
It's still fresh. It's still there. But we, as adults, we've gone off the deep end and said, there has to be proof. And that was what was always frustrating for me, was you have a philosophy, a belief system. If it requires you to show me evidence, i.e. the ark on top of Mount Ararat, or some other quote-unquote evidence, it's no longer belief.
Right.
It can't be, because now you have fact to back it up or not.
So you're no longer – it's no longer an imaginal game.
Yeah.
And I think there's this really, in my opinion, obnoxious German philosopher named Feuerbach, and he's trying to say that religious stage, he thinks there's a comparison between collective evolution and individual growing up. So in the first stage, you're religious, in your next stage, you're philosophical, and the next stage, you're scientific, and this is individual and cultural. So the imagination fades culturally and on the individual level as you grow, from his point of view. I'm very much not a fan of this model. And I think actually it's flipping it around on its head. Maybe you might want to say something, Jeffrey, about how perhaps we're not evolving away from imagination, but to employ it more.
Right. I think actually our handling of the imagination is more evidence that we've become spiritually stupid. You know, we handle the imagination only as the imaginary.
As fake.
It's just fake. And again, this is how we think of mind. Mind is just fake.
Mm-hmm.
It's not real. It's just an ephemeral product of the brain doing its thing. And imagination is nothing more than fantasy and make-believe. But actually, again, if you look at the history of religions, there are really sophisticated visionaries and mystics that know what they're seeing is not literally true, but that it's mediating some truth about another world or about some aspect of human nature that is actually true and can't be expressed in any way, the symbolic or the mythical. So we've lost this kind of both and, what I call the both and approach, where you can take a symbolic or mythical experience and recognize both its fictional nature and its truth value at the same time. You know, for example, a lot of telepathic experiences, what they used to call veridical hallucinations, you know, these are the classic ones where you're in bed at 2:25 in the morning, waving goodbye and blowing you a kiss. And you know, grandma, you know, you're dreaming or you're hallucinating, but it turns out the next day that grandma died at 2:25 a.m. in the morning. So there you have an event that was mediated by the dreaming imagination, no question about it. Nobody's arguing that point. And yet, something really real was coming through.
Yeah.
And that's where I think we fail on all of this stuff. That's why we reject alien abductions. That's why we reject ghost stories. That's why, because they're so fantastic. They're so gothic and robustly.
And we can only hear it literally. Either it's literally true or it's false.
Yeah. And we don't have this middle way. We don't have this third way. And I think that's the way to go, actually, is that third way.
And you're really interested in reforming the methodology of religious studies. This must be a big part of it for you.
Well, you know, when I was trained in the early 80s and then late 80s at Chicago, the symbol and the myth were still grand terms that were thought of very positively. But as my friend Jez Hollenbeck has pointed out to me, you never, ever hear a language of the symbolic anymore. Because
unless you hang out with me.
Well, you don't hear it at our national meet. The religious believers will often find it offensive because you're saying that their beliefs aren't literally true, right?
Right.
And the materialists and the reductionists find it too romantic because you're actually suggesting that there's truth value in religious experience.
Right.
And so, you know, it's sort of fallen away, but it's still a very powerful way of looking at things. And I think it's the most accurate way to describe what people actually experience. You talk to them.
So to keep getting through some of the things I really want to get to while we're here, I think we ought to at least get to some of these comic books. I want to ask about, you know, you do some real work to show that comic books and pulps and science fiction, there's not just some vague connection to the paranormal or occult. Actually, the writers are interested in it. You document it and put the magnifying glass all the way down to the details of the word. And to start with Superman, who, and quoting you, Superman comic came out in 1938 and sold millions of copies, is generally accepted as having created the comic book industry as an important publishing business. But when it was common, what we recognize about Superman, everybody will tell you, is that this is an alien story applied to the Christ story. But what's not as acknowledged is the occult qualities that went in. And sure enough, you mentioned that the two writers actually had, the writer and artist had actually written a comic called Dr. Mystic, the Occult Detective, which is about a character who travels the spirit world at the speed greater than light itself. So I was wondering if you could jump in with those two and maybe talk a little bit about the real deep relationship between the paranormal and comic books and science fiction.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, well, you did it well there, Will. Yeah, I mean, the Superman narrative is just one. It's kind of a meta example because he really is iconic.
Yeah.
But if you look at Dr. Mystic, the occult detective, he looks exactly like Superman, great Superman, who is basically a crashed alien.
Mm-hmm.
And so right off the bat, you have occultism and you have this alien trope. But even before Superman, you know, with the pulps, the pulp fiction writers are reading Charles Fort, by the way, you know, this who really invented the paranormal.
Mm-hmm.
And so Fort's writing between 1919 and 1932. The pulps start in the 20s, and they sort of come into their own in their pulp magazines. And if you open up one of these pulp fiction magazines, there's actually ads in them with coupons to cut out to how to develop your own superpowers.
Yeah, you said that. Amazing.
How to become a Rosicrucian, right in it, you know?
Amazing.
So there's this fusion of the two. And it turns out that if you look at the history of Pulp Fiction and comic books in particular, the most productive people, the most famous editors, writers, and artists in sci-fi and Pulp Fiction and the comic book worlds are the same individuals who are the most interested in the paranormal and who often had paranormal experiences.
That is well documented in Mutants and Mystics. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, that's a good book.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the argument. It's not that just the paranormal is a subtext of these pop, and the superpowers and the punching and the technology is really all kind of a materialist sci-fi cape, as it were, over this paranormal figure, right? And mm-hmm. and I think that's the case because these artists and authors had these sorts of experiences, and they were looking for ways to express this.
So let me ask you about one specific one. You want to tell us about Ray Palmer?
Well, so Ray Palmer is kind of the classic example here. Ray Palmer was probably the most influential Pulp Fiction editor of the 40s and 50s. When he was 5 or 6, I don't remember his age, he was hit by a butcher truck, broke his back, stopped his growth, one of these horrible beds to kind of, you know, stretch him out and so his back could heal straight. And so this poor kid was suspended for literally months, and he claimed that he developed essentially mental superpowers. He could remember back before his conception.
Wow. I met a guy who said that too, but I didn't believe him.
Yeah, I don't know. I think Ray meant it.
Ray might have meant it.
You know, he also sat and wrote a lot of things I don't think he meant. He was a kind of a trickster figure.
Oh.
And, but he was also obsessed with flying saucers, and he got into cahoots with Ken Arnold, the guy who saw the first flying saucer, as it were, in 1947. And you know, Palmer basically is the guy who brought flying saucers and paranormal superpowers into the sci-fi world, among others. But he was really made.
And sounds like a guy that actually had the real experiences. He really studied it. And he even claimed some powers, and he was one of the main writers. It's incredible.
Right, right. But again, it's the fiction and the fact are, they're so intertwined that it's, I don't think you can pull them apart.
Yeah, even the real stuff is mixed with the fiction, and the fiction's mixed with the real stuff. So,
right.
On that note, let me ask just a cherry pick of a question. Is there a consistency in your mind between the powers of superheroes, shamans, mystics, occultists, terrestrial beings, aliens, gods? Are these different powers for different characters, or are they touching on something similar?
I think they're all getting at the basic idea that we're not who we think we are. You know, in the book, I developed this motif I call the humanist two. You know, there's Will and Richard and Jeff. That's the ego. But there's this sort of cosmic mind that's also trickling in, filtering through in a very, at least in me, maybe not in you guys, but in me. But occasionally in life, when we're suffering or when we're in a traumatic situation, or maybe it's the beauty of a mountain or an orgasm, or who knows, it can be anything. This mind comes rushing in. And suddenly we realize we have superpowers. Now, we don't really have superpowers. Will and Jeff don't wear capes and fly around, but mine does. Mine really does fly around and really does have abilities that are essentially superpowers.
Ah, but you make assumptions, sir.
What's that?
I said you make assumptions, sir, that I don't fly around with a cape.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm sorry, Richard. I thought it was a pretty safe assumption.
I did when I was a kid. My mom's towels.
Yeah,
the big
so
ones.
I was Batman.
Batman, you know, yeah.
Put
the Batman record on and put the bath towel on and jump around.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So,
ruined my bath towel.
Richard's giving me the 5-minute sign, and so I'm going to ask one last question. before Richard goes in with his concluding questions. And we didn't get a chance to really go through your super story, which is, again, really want to recommend Mutants and Mystics. And just as a tangent, I will say that the super story is incredibly consistent with the paranormal experience that I've left off the table in this conversation. but I do want to ask for you to describe authorship, because that seems to be one of the most valuable messages in your book.
Right. So before this book, I wrote another one called Authors of the Impossible. And the basic argument there that if you really look closely at people's paranormal experiences, they look a lot like texts. They look like stories that we get caught in. And so one of the ways I define a paranormal experience is it's a story that you stop into. Mm-hmm. And so people will often say, it felt like I was in a movie, or it felt like I was a character in a novel. And my message is, that's exactly what you are. You know, we are all characters in a novel called culture, or in a movie called religion. And we're written by our ancestors. And I think what the paranormal is as a whole are these little wake-up calls inside the movie or the novel that, hey, maybe I don't even like this story. Maybe I want to step off the page or out of the screen and tell a different story. And so that's what I mean by becoming an author of the impossible, is taking a hold of our paranormal experiences, however humble, however few, and using them to rewrite ourselves and our cultures.
Thank you. That's great. Well, let's turn it over to Richard, and we'll wind up.
First of all, I want to thank you for joining us here on our series, Mythosophia, Entertaining the Depths of Myth and Wisdom. And as I often do on these programs with our guests, I have three questions that I put to our guests. The first one is, who is Jeffrey Kripal?
Spider-Man. So answer that one first.
That is the first question.
Yeah, so Jeff Kripal's he's a 52-year-old man who, you know, was born in Nebraska and has schluffed his way through life in various ways and is still trying to figure out what we're doing here.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
I really want to authorize the impossible, exactly as I talked about earlier. I want to give people reason and their own authority to tell their stories and to create culture out of those.
And who inspires you?
I am most inspired by people who write me out of the blue with their paranormal experiences.
Hear that, everybody?
Yeah, I'm not encouraging it in any grand way because I get enough email, but no, seriously, I get these letters. I meet these people. These are entirely silent, invisible people otherwise. And they tell me their stories, and they're inevitably remarkable. And I'm just kind of in awe of how weird and wonderful human beings are. And the kind of mundane, boring stuff we do every day really isn't the whole picture. I'm kind of in awe of that.
And how can people find out more about you and what you're doing, the books, all of the various topics that you cover? Where would they go?
Well, I have my own website at Rice University, and I think it does a pretty good job of summarizing everything. I always tell people to go there.
Okay.
You can get all the books on Amazon, but you won't find as much material as on the website. But they both work. They both work fine.
And all of that will be linked into the Mythosophia website for the page on this interview.
Absolutely.
Also, I would recommend JonesCinemaArts.com. Scott Jones is my good friend here. We're working on these two documentaries, and there's a lot of resources on Scott's website as well, JonesCinemaArts.com.
And I meant to ask you, would you be interested in us posting the teasers on the page link?
I don't see why not. Great. I mean, that's a Scott question.
Okay.
They're on his website. I assume you can just link to that, right?
Perfect. Yeah.
I mean, he's made them available. Yeah.
great.
Well, again, Jeffrey, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a pleasure, and it's just extraordinary stuff. Thank you again for joining us.
Thanks, Richard. Thanks, Will.
Thanks, Jeff.
Will, thank you so much for joining us here on Myth of Sophia, entertaining the depths and the depths of myth and wisdom. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make our dreams come true. And until next week, as well as next month, at the end of September, we'll have part 9 in our Myth of Sophia series. Who are we going to have?
That'll be Steven Eisenstadt, president and founder of Pacifica Graduate Institute.
Excited about that. That's going to be fun. Thank you, Will, for sharing this time and the microphone with me today.
Thanks.
Until next time, love to Lal.